As fresh as reality, I stand here before you to profess to deliver the second in a series of inaugural lectures here at Sussex this summer term, this evening of the 8th day of May 2007, as you are my witness. I confess that I feel as if I am dreaming, that I have from the moment of being invited to give this lecture, almost a year ago now, felt a gathering dreaminess, a sense of not being quite able to believe it, anxiety and exhilaration, unprecedented pleasure and trepidation at the same time. As fresh as reality, I want to say first of all thank you, without knowing how to thank you, everyone who has come here this evening. Some of you I know from a great distance, Lucy and Saleh, for example, from more than 5,000 miles away. Vanessa, from a few dozen miles that might nonetheless have felt like a few thousand. For how is one to measure distance? What is distance? That is one of my dreaming questions. Thank you, Jinan. Thank you, Vice-Chancellor, for your, as ever, friendly and kind words. And thank you, Geoffrey, for agreeing to give what is known as the vote of thanks. And then, already there from before the beginning, I want to thank those who are not here, those who are distant in ways that just throw me, swirling in currents at a depth I cannot gauge, between shifting forms of Scylla and Charybdis I am not sure I could even recognise, those who are distant in some respects perhaps, but at the same time closer than I feel I am to myself, if I can say that, in the dreaming octopus of 8 years that I am, as if I were trying to write with eight hands, with so many different kinds of addressee, and this also being, as you are my witness, my 8th year, 8 years now that I have been here at Sussex and honoured with the title of Professor. The professorial or inaugural lecture is a strange event. I am putting event in quotation marks because I am not sure, especially in my dreamy state, whether what is happening will have been an event, even though it has been kindly coordinated by the Sussex University events manager, Sue Hepburn, whom I would also hereby like to thank, and first of all, for issuing the invitation for me to speak. No event without surprise, no event without what cannot be foreseen or predicted, or dare I say, managed. There are at least 4 ways in which this kind of lecture is different from other kinds of university lecture. First of all, as a matter of possible relief to all listeners, there are no questions at the end. Second, and as something of a counter to that incipient relief, there is, so far as I understand it, no stated limit to the duration of this lecture. Third, the professorial or inaugural lecture is conventionally regarded as the opportunity for the speaker to offer some account of what he or she has been doing in previous writing, research and publications, and to offer an account of where this work is going, of what is to come. Points 2 and 3, you quickly realise, are a recipe for disaster. But I hereby promise, and everything here is about promising, on one side or the other, I hereby promise to keep this lecture as short as possible, in the circumstances. Within reason? No. Not only within reason, it must be said. As Freud notes in one of his earliest publications, we are all insane in our dreams. There has to be at least a bit of madness, a decent bite, something to get one's teeth into. Still, at least a part of me would like these remarks to be incredibly short. For some years now, I have indeed been dreaming about ways of getting quicker, making lectures shorter and shorter. In Florida, in 1995, I gave a lecture called Nanotext, of which I remember virtually nothing apart from the opening sentence, which runs, "What follows is part of a much smaller project." Still, I dream of that project. getting smaller every day, as in what Wallace Stevens somewhere calls, apropos of poetry of the future, a wizened starlight growing young. Finally, fourth way, the professorial lecture is the speaker's one institutionally sanctioned, officially designated chance to address an audience that goes beyond the academic, to offer a public lecture that is addressed not only to colleagues and students, but also to family and friends outside the university. The fringe, even. By convention, and perhaps most touchingly and profoundly for the speaker, this might, with luck, include his or her parents. Impossible this last for me. Since coming to Sussex in the autumn of 1999, my mother and father have both died. But of course, just because it's impossible doesn't mean that it's not desired, or indeed that it's not what, at some level, is happening right now. One is continually addressing one's parents or responding, inadvertently responding or trying to respond to them in one way or another. How could I have begun to speak here this evening, or you perhaps to listen, without that spectral logic whereby we seek to address and engage, or find ourselves having been from the beginning addressing or engaging with those who are dead? Loved ones known in life but gone away, but also those never known, the missing, the presumed or unpresumed, ancestral voices, as Coleridge says, including the writers and thinkers one loves. It's a question, as I suggested a few moments ago, of the experience of the promise and of ghosts. In my unconscious, I use that phrase in the possessive form, my unconscious, with a sense of laughter, irony and the ridiculous, of which more I hope later. In my unconscious, I know, this sentence becomes inevitably more farcical as it goes on, and I am inclined, as so often, to veer and turn elsewhere, but it's too late, I know. In my unconscious, I know I am anxious. For I have kept catching myself mentally referring to this evening for several months now, in my mind, not as the professorial lecture or the inaugural lecture, but as the trial lecture. I confess, let me go. But no, the unconscious doesn't let go. It wraps itself around us, it conceals itself from ourselves from it, conceals ourselves from ourselves, it gives no port or resting place, and the moment it's fished up, it's not there. This phrase, trial lecture, is one I encountered nearly 20 years ago when I was on the verge of becoming unemployed at the end of a one-year lectureship, my first proper academic job at the University of Tampere in Finland. I applied for a further post, and happily I was shortlisted and asked to give what the Finnish university authorities called a trial lecture. It was to be 20 minutes long precisely, and was supposed to focus on a Robert Browning dramatic monologue, the chilling little masterpiece called My Last Duchess. It was one of the worst lectures I ever gave. Everything I could have done wrong, I did. I was supposed to show expertise in the deployment of pedagogical accoutrements, an appropriate lecture handout, effective manipulation of an overhead projector and transparencies, writing on the blackboard without turning my back to the audience. I failed on every front and back. I lost all sense of time, like a sea creature swirled in oniric space, not even capable of scuttling, to recall one of T.S. Eliot's most beautiful phrasings, I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. I had planned to give a line-by-line commentary on Browning's poem in the 20 minutes allotted, but had not even reached the halfway mark when a cold and knife-like voice from a man in a grey suit in the front row announced, "Time is over." I felt like a mixture of a character in Kafka and the Last Duchess herself. The poem is all about the macabre way in which her time is over, even though she was just a teenager. Humiliated and hopeless, I obeyed and left the building, only an hour or two later to receive a phone call and be offered the job. This evening, it appears that I already have the job, so I presume I only stand to lose it. job. Bodge in reverse. We forget, but as Freud notes, I say Freud notes in the present tense, despite his being dead, he would have been 151, I believe, the day before yesterday. A present tense thus signalling the ghostly time of writing, but also perhaps of reading or of listening. Freud notes the unconscious is quite timeless. The time of the trial lecture never ends, even as the end is announced. So when I caught myself mentally referring to this evening as the trial lecture, I knew deep down it meant trouble. Deep down trouble. A cloud of black ink. 8 years I have been waiting. A waiting trial lecture. Why? What should I make of that? For a period of 7 years, as if in a fairy tale, I wondered if they might come. If they, she, he, whoever they might be, the authorities, and summon me with an invitation. Was the fact that I didn't receive an invitation a good thing, indicative of a sense that I had arrived at Sussex and settled in so well that no one had noticed its occurrence? Or did it suggest that the university had made a clanger in appointing me and wanted to do its best not to draw any further attention to the fact? Did it mean, as I still fear, that I have not yet arrived? Was it all a test? Of course it was a test, but what kind of test? Is this normal? Am I normal? I have often asked myself down the years. Or are there others who, like me, have waited 8 years, or indeed perhaps even longer? Someone should perhaps do a research paper on this topic. Deferred entry, the life of the contemporary professor, perhaps, or cryonic professors, or the professoriate that time forgot. But now, it must be understood, the day has come, as in a dream, and I am here, summoned and duly present, as you are my witness, fresh as reality. Preparing for this trial lecture, and meditating on all these questions, I kept thinking also of one of the best things I ever heard emerge from English football terraces. There was a period, but when is it not the period, 10 or 20 years ago, when Fulham were doing pretty badly, somewhere low down in the second division or wherever. And in one game, the play was interrupted by an injury. And while the players were waiting for the game to recommence, someone in the stand close to the touchline shouted out at the Fulham players, "Don't just stand there, practice!" Every university lecture is a trial lecture. Not simply in the sense of an anxious, uncertain experience, at least for the lecturer. Of course, no lecture worthy of the name should be unduly annoying to its audience. It shouldn't be altogether a trial for you. Even though, I can't help saying, the pedagogical value and significance of being annoying is something perhaps insufficiently acknowledged. There are supposed to be such things as learning outcomes in the university, or on its borders, or perhaps outside. It's never been clear to me whether learning outcomes would be inside or outside, a formidable question we can here only pretend to pass over and put to one side. At moments I find myself suspecting that learning outcomes is just a sort of administrative parapraxis for what is brought in by students, a slip of the spreadsheet, a botched cover-up for learning incomes. But I would like, if the irreducibly fictional and phantasmatic concept of learning outcomes is to be carried on, to propose the inclusion of some new categories, guided by the pedagogical principle that lectures, seminars or classes should, if at all possible, be annoying. At least a bit. I mean helpfully or surprisingly annoying, or even, in a nicely ambiguous formulation, annoying for good. This is in part what makes writers like D.H. Lawrence and E.M. Forster so lovable for all their apparent faults. They like to annoy. Their texts propound the beauty, force and value of annoying. But I won't go on. You perhaps already have a sense of how annoying it could become. No one, I feel sure, will feel the slightest irritation at my invoking the name Jacques Derrida. I would like to pay homage here to him. As a beloved friend, who is, it appears, not here, apparently beyond all distance. But also as the greatest philosopher of our time, and here specifically as the most remarkable and inspiring contemporary thinker of the university and its future. Every lecture is a trial lecture in the sense that, if it is to be worthy of the name, the very idea of the university would be in question, put to the test, on trial. This is one of the things he says or implies consistently in his writings. In every lecture, class or seminar, every day of the so-called teaching year, with students and the research community, as he says, in every operation we pursue, a reading, an interpretation, and so on, an institutional concept is at play, a type of contract signed, an image of the ideal seminar constructed, a socius implied, repeated or displaced, invented, transformed, menaced or destroyed. Professorial lecture would be an especially precarious example, since it is, by definition, supposed to be addressed to those outside as well as inside the university. As with the strictly unfathomable, unreadable phrase, learning outcomes, it is one of the places where, to borrow a phrase from him, the university is exposed to reality. In an essay entitled The Future of the Profession or the University Without Condition, Thanks to the Humanities, What Could Take Place Tomorrow, originally a lecture delivered in 1999, Derrida offers us a rich and provoking exploration of what ties the university to democracy, above all in relation to freedom of speech and of research, the university as the place which should be without condition. The place with, in principle, absolute freedom concerning what is taught and what research gets done and what publications emerge from it. He also sketches a rather mind-boggling account of what it means to profess and to be a professor, concluding with an outline of seven ways of thinking about what he calls the humanities of tomorrow or the new humanities. I won't attempt a detailed commentary and analysis of his remarkable essay here, but we'll just focus briefly on what he says about professing and being a professor. He notes, first of all, that the word profess is of Latin origin. Profitior, fessus sum, eri, pro et fatior, which means to speak, from which also comes fable, and thus a certain as if. To profess is to declare openly, to declare publicly. And he goes on. The declaration of the one who professes is a performative declaration in some way. It pledges like an act of sworn faith, an oath, a testimony, a manifestation, an attestation or a promise, a commitment. To profess is to make a pledge while committing one's responsibility. Already it is perhaps apparent how palpably the professor is a sort of fabrication, a sort of magicked up figure or figure in a dream, as if in a dream, as I said at the beginning, as you are my witness. Inaugurality. That is the word I dreamed of starting with, a dream word, admittedly not to be found in any dictionary, but a portmanteau neologism that enfolds the performative and the real, while also, in its omen-like auguring, appearing to testify to the logic of a certain magic. The professor is one who professes, whose very identity and function, within and beyond the university, with or without event management, has to do with what is called the performative. That is to say, with what the philosopher J.L. Austin calls the speech act. Not simply with saying something, but with doing something by saying. As in acts of naming, declaring love, or war, making a bet, or promising. The professor is to be defined and essentially conceived as promising. This promise, this pledge of responsibility identified with the one who professes, Derrida goes on to say, is reducible to neither theory nor practice. This is a simple sounding but extraordinary remark, I think. What a professor is, if or when there is one, has to do with the experience of a promise, with what Derrida elsewhere refers to as the experience of the being promise of a promise. There is something a bit fabulous, excessive, and even comical about this. Believe me. Because the act of professing is a performative speech act, Derrida says, and because the event that it is, or produces, depends only on this linguistic promise, its proximity to fable, to fabulation and to fiction, to the as if, will always be formidable. End of quotation. When, you may have started asking yourself, is Nicholas Royle going to get to the point and start talking about the topic specified in the lecture title, "It's as bad as waiting for Godot"? But perhaps also it is becoming apparent that this is what I have been doing, professing to do from my very first words. The professor is in deconstruction, Derrida says. No wonder I have been feeling anxious. We are witnessing the end of a certain figure of the professor and of his or her supposed authority, he says. In the old days, a professor was someone who produced knowledge or pre-knowledge. The professor was not an author, not someone who signed an oeuvre. Derrida writes, in the classical modern tradition, a professor as such does not sign an oeuvre. His or her authority as professor is not that of the author of an oeuvre, a work. It is perhaps this that has been changing over the last few decades. Encountering the frequently indignant resistance and protestations of those who believe they can distinguish, in writing and in language, between criticism and creation. Reading and writing, the professor and the author, and so on. Both because of and despite this deconstruction, I believe, like Jacques Derrida, in a certain necessity of the professoriat. It is a question of the future of professing, of the professor in deconstruction, of criticism and creation, of the responsibilities of a professor in the humanities to come. In other words, of reckoning with the question, what happens, not only when one takes into account the performative value of profession, but when one accepts that a professor produces oeuvres and not just knowledge or pre-knowledge. In the new humanities, the critical and deconstructive focus of attention would be above all on what Derrida passionately affirmed as the democracy to come. A new enlightenment and a new international. The need, in the first instance, profoundly to transform international law, its concepts and its field of intervention, so that it cover the worldwide economic and social field. In this thinking of what he called a new enlightenment and the democracy to come, there is a bit, a strange but compelling and absolutely irreducible, indestructible bit that has to do with literature. It is a matter of how, especially in his writings on literature, fiction and poetry, Derrida's work has altered our understanding of notions of the performative, the author, the signature, singularity, the gift, hospitality, friendship, sovereignty, and the law, and how his work has opened up a new conception and practice of writing exceeding traditional distinctions between the fictional and the real. Beginning with the title of this lecture this evening, Reality Literature. Everything depends on the as in Derrida's remarkable analysis and transformation of the as-if, drawing on the as-if in Kant, Weichinger, and Freud, but also singular and new, as in my opening words, as fresh as reality and as you are my witness. Permit me to call to attention one final proposition from Derrida's essay on the University Without Condition. It comes in the middle of the seven propositions, or professions of faith, as he calls them, concerning the new humanities or the humanities to come. Here is his profession, his proposition number 4. These new humanities would treat, in a deconstructive style, the history of literature. Not only what is commonly called history of literatures or literature themselves, with the great question of its canons, traditional and indisputable objects of the classical humanities, but the history of the concept of literature, of the modern institution named literature, of its links with fiction and the performative force of the as-if, of its concept of oeuvre, author, signature, national language, of its link with the right to say or not to say everything that founds both democracy and the idea of the unconditional sovereignty claimed by the university and within it by what is called, inside and outside departments, the humanities. How might reality literature fit in with the history of literature and of the concept of literature? You see, I am already talking about this thing, reality literature, as if the phrase were referring to something, some concept or some kind of writing. By way of clarification, I will try to say a little more about the phrase with which I began, as fresh as reality. This is a quotation, a strange and haunting formulation from Emily Bronte's book, first published in 1847, Wuthering Heights. Some months before the death of Hindley Earnshaw, whom she hasn't seen for a good while, to tell you or remind you in advance, there's a premonitory or foretelling dimension to what is about to be described, the housekeeper, Nellie Dean, is recalling how she was walking one bright, frosty afternoon past an old highway stone, a weather-worn block marking the place where the road goes off in three directions, to the village of Gimmerton, to Thrushcross Grange, and to Wuthering Heights. Quote, "I cannot say why, but all at once a gush of child sensations flowed into my heart. Hindley and I held it a favourite spot 20 years before. I gazed long at the weather-worn block and, stooping down, perceived a hole near the bottom still full of snail shells and pebbles, which we were fond of storing there with more perishable things. And as fresh as reality, it appeared that I beheld my early playmate seated on the withered turf, his dark square head bent forward and his little hands scooping out the earth with a piece of slate. Poor Hindley," I exclaimed involuntarily. I started. My bodily eye was cheated into a momentary belief that the child lifted its face and stared straight into mine. It vanished in a twinkling, but immediately I felt an irresistible yearning to be at the heights. Superstition urged me to comply with this impulse. Supposing he should be dead, I thought, or should soon die, supposing it were a sign of death. Now, I must confess that I could devote many hours to talking about this bit of Bronte. It might detain us, I promise you, for a really, really long time. Not least because a lecture, in order to be worthy of the name lecture, should offer a reading. That, after all, is what the word lecture, from the Latin legere, to read, implies. And this passage from Wuthering Heights makes a very powerful demand on me to try to read it. Reading doesn't happen very often. Let's remember Paul de Man's witty but enduringly provocative remark that the impossibility of reading should not be taken too lightly. This impossibility is not a negative thing. It is linked to the notion of the impossible as, in Derrida's words, what is most undeniably real. As he elsewhere emphasizes, unreadability does not arrest reading, does not leave it paralyzed in the face of an opaque surface. Rather, it starts reading and writing and translation moving again. To read this little bit from Bronte's book would require, apart from anything else, an analysis and elaboration of the ways in which it might be said to incorporate, almost literally to swallow up, the entire structure and logic of the work of which it appears it is just a part. I will confine myself here, however, simply to three quick remarks, like three routes or directions leading from the weather-worn stone, each intended in its own way to indicate something of the singularity of Bronte's book and its continuing inspiration to a critical and creative thinking of literature today and the possibilities of literary writing in the future. First, there is the astonishing speed and the various kinds of simultaneous ingenious engineering work at work in the voice of the writing. In this fictive professing of the all at once, the gushing, the momentary belief, what is exclaimed involuntarily, the starting, I started, the vanishing in a twinkling, and the immediacy of irresistible yearning. All of this is to be read and heard in the voice of a woman, Nellie, transcribed and dubbed by the voice of another narrator, Lockwood, all as if transcribed in turn by the author, invisibly in the author's voice. Of all the contemporary writers whose work I know, only Hélène Cixous does speed in a way that might compare with Bronte. The literature of the new humanities will need more than ever to feed on, reckon with, and respond to the question of speed. Second, Bronte's book, I am still hesitating for the moment to call it a novel, has immense pertinence and indeed urgency for thinking about what might be called the battlefield of childhood. The battlefield or war zone of childhood as the place where the future of literature is perhaps duly to be elucidated. How are we made to forget our childhoods? How is the child at work in the creative writer of today and tomorrow and in the teacher or professor? Third, this short extract from Wuthering Heights seems playfully at once to immerse itself in and distance itself from a world of superstition, magical thinking and telepathy. In this duplicity, this at once, it discombobulates the very question and experience of distance. On the one hand, it looks as if the narrator, Nellie Dean, is a classic case of that sort of superstitious, even obsessional character to be described by Freud some 65 years later in Totem and Taboo, 1912. Quote, "If he thought of someone, he would be sure to meet that very person immediately afterwards, as though by magic. If he suddenly asked after the health of an acquaintance whom he had not seen for a long time, he would hear that he had just died, so that it would look as though a telepathic message had arrived from him." On the other hand, the very structure and narratorial multiplicity of Bronte's writing appears to presuppose and indeed inscribe a telepathic logic. This is Nellie after the fact, telling Lockwood after the fact, as reported by the author or author figure working from the perspective of a time when all is already over, already seen and foreseen, voiced and written and so on. Telepathy or magical thinking is the very oxygen, or if you will, the oxygenous book. And that is, at least in part, what makes it as fresh as reality. As fresh as reality. She, Bronte, writes. He, Lockwood, writes. She, Nellie Dean, says. It appeared that I beheld my early playmate seated on the withered turf. She, he, she, we are subject to, thinking about, an hallucination, it appears. Not as plain as day, but as fresh as reality. What kind of housekeeper's colloquialism is that? Here, in this remarkable and bizarre phrase that perhaps has no precedent in the history of English literature, as fresh as reality, undecidably fresh as if it were reality, fresh to the same degree as reality is fresh, fresh in the same way as reality, undecidably corresponding to but distinct from reality and or identical with reality in its freshness, still here at the opening of a grammatical unfolding without identifiable subject, it appeared, there is an appearance, moreover an appearance as the sentence will in a moment reveal that is an apparition, an it apparitioned, and we are still hanging in a vertigo of suspended relation, as if at the very suspension of the heights, it appeared that I beheld. It appeared that I beheld an hallucination, an apparition, or, as the narratorial voice goes on to call it, a sign. These apparently simple clauses, apparently simply ordered, as fresh as reality, it appeared, I beheld, offer a sort of microdrama of the lucid but meddling, twinkling installations of reality within appearance, apparition, hallucination or dream, and conversely of appearance, apparition, hallucination or dream within reality, not to mention apparition within appearance, dream within dream, and so on, all under the rubric of disturbed or unreliable witnessing. It appeared, I beheld. That is the very scene of writing and reading of the book. I should maybe have given you a little epigraph from Freud. Reality, when I talk about it, it's as if to send you to sleep. To conclude, did he say? But he hasn't said anything yet about the title. He's been regaling us with a few anecdotes and friendly remarks, and he's also been a bit annoying. But let that rest. In any case, he hasn't really said anything yet. You know, thought the author. These things happen from time to time, my father says. He's lying on the bed, his single bed alongside the other, which still made up was my mother's, dying 2 years earlier. And the covers are off, and I'm trying to get him up and dressed, ready for hospital, but I'm weeping. Tears are streaming down my face, making it difficult to see, and I'm unclear where this uncontrollable flow of grief has come from. Unenvisaged. Embarrassing. Until now, I have managed to remain quite calm, like him. I discussed the case over the phone with the doctor and agreed the best thing would be to get him into hospital, where they could make him more comfortable. If it's possible to persuade your dad, see what you can do. I know old folk don't necessarily the fossil-like power of his habits, he could always amaze me, turn out to have been thinking or not entirely elsewhere, for years impossible to get him to go anywhere, come out for a drink, walk by the sea, drive down the Devon lanes over the hills. I didn't expect him to agree, but he did, without the faintest remonstrance. Yes, take me to the hospital. He's lying on the bed, and he is like flesh. His body, mine. And so difficult, so complicated, he'll say shortly, in a portmanteau coming apart at the seams, just when it will have become to my mind most straightforward, so deluded. Give up the thought of the sentence, he seems to tell me, and I am in his grip, he mine, here and from now on. I prop him up, help him sit, we remove his bedclothes and get him dressed. Stertorous is the wrong word, but hangs in the air, the way the most ordinary thing, getting dressed, becomes impracticable, fateful, tangled up with words and images from a song or book, the grotesque persnicketiness of Edgar Allan Poe, the stertorous breathing of Monsieur Valdemar, figure of impossible resuscitated putrefaction. The stertorous word hangs in the air like a silent spy plane, shadow show of gallows. That is where living begins. To pronounce dead is to murder, he wrote. All the time, the other bed, to her, my father and I, all the time aware, though we do not exchange a syllable, unoccupied. Yesterday I called the doctor in. He asked my father if it would be possible to go upstairs so that he could examine him on the bed, and we all went up together, one by one, three bears, me at the back, the doctor in the middle, each of us holding on to the handrail as we went. The doctor remarking with admiration on its crafting, smooth but knotty trunk of a young pine fallen in the garden years ago, meticulously bolted to the stairway wall by my father. Solid silver, yes. Silver, silvi, the way words twinkle to others' uses, other to her, solid flesh, melting into dew, slivering into you, my father makes to lie down on his bed, but the doctor asks him to lie down on the other bed, because it is closer to the window and he'll be able to see better. My father, looking over at it, he says, my wife's bed. My wife, he says, pronouncing the words very carefully, his speech become fuzzy especially in the preceding few days, and he strives to overcome it. I can hear the struggle. At innumerable moments in the past, he has referred to her as me wife, in deliberate loving lapse of propriety. That was me wife's bed. But he doesn't venture it now. We seem to have embarked on some new phase of language. For some days there has been an eerie formality, an explicitness almost disembodied in referring to his anatomy and bodily functions, urinating, retraction of the penis, excreting, liquid stools, incontinence, as if this new emphasis on the proper heralds some strange homecoming, the rending mystery of my father. Is there fear and confusion, or only respect, love, even awe, when he objects, as if to say, but I cannot lie down there, that was my wife's bed. Yet the doctor insists on that bed, it is closer to the window, he says. He'll be able to see better, to see, what is it, magically thinking, my father complies, but now it is today, nearly 24 hours later, and we say nothing about the other bed, unoccupied, constantly in our minds, no, not stertorous, more wheezeful, softer, gulping, an immeasurably beautiful, strange, ancient fish, glopping, glooping, groping, grasping, rasping for air, at air, sitting up, slowly, so slowly to get dressed, article by article, until the socks. I am dressing my father for the first time in my life. That is from the beginning of the book I have been working on over the past year or two. What is it? It is not, I profess, a work of literary criticism or theory, or a novel, or autobiography. As Virginia Woolf asks herself in parentheses in her diary entry for the 27th of June 1925, apropos to The Lighthouse, I have an idea that I will invent a new name for my books, to supplant novel, a new, by Virginia Woolf. But what? Elegy? This book that I am writing, or this book that is writing me, currently around 40,000 words, is about the death of the author's father and mother, and it is also about aquatic creatures, especially rays, both marine and freshwater. Mostly South American species. The book is my version, after Woolf, of what might be called a ray of one's own. It has to do with the notion of the lungfish, from which we are all descended. But it also has to do with the word ray, its various homonyms and homophones, and its anagrammatic apparitions in so many other words, including, perhaps above all, reality. The word reality, like the word real, goes back to the Latin res, meaning thing. Here, res, in more than one voice, more than one language, across 1,000, then 1,000,000, then many millions of years. My work on res has to do with mourning and elegy and what is as fresh as reality. It is a book that shares preoccupations with others I have written, above all in relation to deconstruction, for example, of the figure of the author, and in relation to the dissolution of the novel. I am driven and swirl, whirled on, even if it is to be torn to pieces by what I believe, by what I profess. In other words, especially when I cannot see where it might be taking me or us. I recall here a witty remark made by another writer whose work I love, Leo Bassani. In the prologue to his great book, The Culture of Redemption, he says that in what follows he will, as in earlier books, be analysing and questioning, I quote, fundamental assumptions about authoritative identities, about identity as authority. He remarks, I recognise that, in saying all this, I also confirm a slightly dispiriting consistency in my own work. But then, in a seductive gesture of passive defiance, he adds, in a mode of explanatory confession, which is also an act of professing, that he considers his work to be a kind of moral criticism, especially insofar as, I quote, this involves a certain indifference to criticism anxious to teach us the difference between the literary and the non-literary. That last is, I would say, a marvellously annoying statement. thought the author. I'm sorry, that strange phrase again. For lack of time, I must simply note that it is a gift from Hélène Cixous. Thought the author in italics. It appears on the opening page of her remarkable ungenred text, First Days of the Year, Jour de l'An, 1990, a work that takes the figure of the author beside herself, thinking to herself as its ghostly starting point. How to read Woolf's query in her diary, a query that is itself, of course, an example of thought the author, the diary being traditionally the place where an author tells us what he or she is supposedly thinking in a manner different from the world of literary fiction. These lines from her diary appear in a little book I wrote in collaboration with my friend and colleague Andrew Bennett. Let collaboration thrive, especially authorial collaboration in the new humanities. Elizabeth Bowen and the Dissolution of the Novel. For those of you, the majority, who don't know it, this was an absurdly expensive hardback volume published in 1995 and selling at a steady rate of about half a dozen copies a year ever since. My passion for Bowen's work has to do with its unremitting, thoughtful analysis of mourning and ghostliness, its disruptive effects, reversals, loops and veerings concerning distinctions between life and death and between the fictional and real. Like Woolf's, but in a quite singular, formidably heterogeneous way, Bowen's books stage what Andrew Bennett and I call dissolutions. Dissolutions of identity and of the very grounds of realism. A dissolution of the genre, concept and tradition of the novel. Faced with the challenge of giving a sort of telegrammatic distillation of my work, or simply of the focus of that work in this trial lecture, I have long since failed, of course, I know. In a word, what would I say? Mole? Mollusks? Creative and critical writing? Crypts? Ghosts? Derrida? Deconstruction? Freud? The U word? As you are my witness, I pledge not to use the U word here this evening. Bowen? Shakespeare? Veering? That is what I hear my mother saying. Telepathy? Permit me to say something about the last of these. A word and concept I've been trying to think and write about for a couple of decades, beginning with what came to be published as the book called Telepathy and Literature, Essays on the Reading Mind, in 1990. What is telepathy? What is the relation between telepathy and literature? How does the concept of telepathy relate to death, mourning, and ghosts, and to religious and non-religious faith? How do literary works activate and invent, but also depend on, the telepathic? A critical exploration of these questions offers what I believe is a new and promising way of thinking about the history of literature and of the concept of literature, as well as of literature to come. To ask what is telepathy is also to ask what is distance. The word telepathy, of course, a word invented only in 1882, has to do with minds, or thinking, or feeling, or even suffering, the Greek word pathos, and what is distant, tele. One of the things that has preoccupied me for a long time is not only how consistently works of fiction, as well as poetry, interest themselves in telepathy, where telepathy can be understood in a quite traditional sense, occult, spiritualist, mystical, substitute for God or the divine, and so on, but also how they actually inscribe and rely on something telepathic in order to happen at all. You pick up a novel, say the last one that George Eliot completed, Daniel Deronda, and you read the first couple of sentences. Was she beautiful or not beautiful? And what was the secret of form or expression which gave the dynamic quality to her glance? Was the good or the evil genius dominant in those beams? Who is asking these questions? We quickly learn that they have been raised, like ghosts we might say, in the mind of another character, Daniel Deronda himself. Already from the first words of the novel we have magical thinking. The narration depends on the fiction of seeing into the mind of another, of an author or narrator knowing what one or another character is thinking or feeling. It's telepathic. Others, less concerned about falling in with a religious reading of literature, would follow the tradition of a certain Christian literary criticism and call it omniscient narration. Far from wanting to dismiss the question of telepathy in literature, I propose that we continue to elaborate it, as I believe novelists and other writers have themselves been doing for well over a century. On this topic, it seems to me, the great mass of critical thinking is, in various and fundamental ways, decades behind Bronte, Eliot, Dickens, and Hardy, let alone, for example, James, Conrad, Joyce, or Bowen. There is no literature without telepathy, and more particularly, no realism without telepathy. Realism is not so much about believable characters, places, experiences, and events, about furniture, and so many other examples of what Barthes calls narrative luxury, all or at least some of which are taken to be suggestive of what is called the real world or real life. Rather, realism is, first of all, what is secured through magical thinking or telepathy, through the structure of what I have termed, adapting a formulation from Jacques Derrida, being two or more than two to speak, think, feel, or write. Realism remains the great narcotic, in Walter Benjamin's phrase. People are never going to give up this opium. But what might happen, what is both thinkable and necessary, I believe, is a sort of new enlightenment at the level of creative and critical reading, in which the religious and non-religious dimensions and the foundations and inventive possibilities of telepathy in literature are made explicit and analysed and elaborated accordingly. The term reality literature is an attempt to signal in this direction. Recently, I've been trying to explore this logic of telepathy or magical thinking in Shakespeare, in particular as the basis of what A.D. Nuttall, in the subtitle of his celebrated book, A New Mimesis, a little misleadingly calls the representation of reality. For the word reality does not occur in Shakespeare. As Anne Barton puts it, apart from a very few special instances, the word reality cannot be traced anywhere until the late 17th century. Indeed, another curiosity of the early history of the word reality is that in the later 17th century, it also had the now obsolete sense of a sincere expression of opinion or feeling. There is, in other words, a ghostly suggestion of professing in the historical depths of reality. The word real occurs in Shakespeare only three times. But to engage in detail merely with that little handful of references would, I fear, require keeping us here long after dark, beyond the darkness and into the madness of another day, falling into the mesmeric story called The Madness of the Day, the apocalyptic story about the fact that the end is coming, something is happening, the end is beginning. Reading Shakespeare through Blanchot's story, that brief but dazzling text, in the very middle of which, following a crazy account of numerous seemingly incredible, fantastical and surreal experiences, nonetheless reported in a deliriously sharp and pristine prose, the narrator sets aside as a separate paragraph the six-word, apparently simple sentence, "All that was real. Take note." I feel I am running out of time, or at least exhausting your patience and goodwill, and I'm also deeply aware of a sort of imp of the perverse that would have me reaching out and starting to caress with one of my oceanic phantom limbs the strictly insignificant and unmotivated correspondence between reality and my name. the real and the royal. Even though it is this regal association that Shakespeare appears to be making in A Lover's Complaint when he writes, "But quickly on this side the verdict went, his real habitude gave life and grace to appertainings and to ornament, accomplished in himself, not in his case." It is not that I am uninterested in the real and royal, in the roiling chances and strangenesses of Shakespeare's language. How could I not be interested? But that would necessitate a long and doubly annoying meditation, no doubt after the madness of the day, on the work of my friend and namesake, who, I am happy to announce, is also here this evening. As in the case of the X-Files, which is a homophone of the title of one of the anthologies of short stories he has edited, he's out there. Welcome, Nick. Perhaps you'd be kind enough just to wave or say hello. And let people know that I'm telling the truth. Might want to get evidence on camera. The truth is out there, yes. But he's also more in here than some might assume. In particular, as regards that suggestion I made at the start about some people being closer to me than I am to myself, I can here reveal, with a certain amusement and dismay, that a couple of days ago I made a backup copy of my lecture in draft form and sent it, not to myself, as I had intended, but to the other Nicholas Royle. No, I'm most struck now just by the fact that Shakespeare appears to have invented the word unreal. Its first recorded use, according to the OED, is in Macbeth's words to the ghost of Banquo, "Hence, horrible shadow, unreal mockery, hence." Working with, and no doubt in some respects away from the legacy of Nuttall's admirable book, it would perhaps be equally intriguing then to elaborate a reading of Shakespeare and the invention of unreality. Not now. Of the myriad things we have still to read and invent around apropos Shakespeare, one would have to do with what I'd call radiophony, the reality of voice. One of the things that I believe most profoundly connects him with Beckett. As Samuel West said recently, good radio writing is a real art. I think a good radio play is better than any other sort of play, but by the same token, a bad one is so much worse. Radio is the most unforgiving medium, more revealing of untruth than any other. Nothing distracts you from whether you believe the reality of what you are hearing. I've started to hear things, I tell you. As I suggested almost 20 years ago, the question, do you believe in telepathy, need not be regarded as categorically or essentially distinguishable from questions such as, do you believe in the telephone? Or, do you believe in television? Reality literature, I hear myself telling you, that's what I profess to have inaugurated here as the effect of a certain radio telephony. You might be tempted to suppose that it is the first literary genre to be explicitly derived from TV, and certainly it is necessary to reckon with the history of this and other terms. The phrase reality TV dates back, according to the OED, to an article in Newsweek in 1978. On the 20th of March, to be precise, the same day it appears that the first Catherine dies and the second is born in Wuthering Heights. So-called reality TV is above all perhaps a sort of symptom or manifestation of a harder, more critically demanding truth that we are faced with every day in relation to the media, especially television, where everything is constructed, ethnocentric, programmed or programming. As Derrida has specifically remarked in this context, the reality of actuality, however individual, irreducible, stubborn, painful or tragic it may be, only reaches us through fictional devices. Reality literature. Reality literature. How do you say it? Where does the stress lie? Which, if either, is the adjective and which the noun? Which one is subordinate to the other? It's up to you. For example, concerning the nature of testimony, as you are my witness. For as we know, there is no true, serious, real testimony without the possibility of literary fiction. The coining of reality literature, it's up to you to judge what is or isn't counterfeit here, doubtless belongs to a comparatively recent history of literary writing, going back, I would say, at least to James Hogg's Confessions, Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner in 1824. Reality literature is at play in those kinds of literary work which, as Derrida has said, all have in common the fact that they are inscribed in a critical experience of literature. They bear within themselves, or we could also say in their literary act, they put to work a question. The same one, but each time singular and put to work otherwise. What is literature? Or where does literature come from? What should we do with literature? But reality literature would not be a genre. Reality literature would be literature that breaks through literature, exposes and expounds that altogether bare device of being two to speak as another new thinking of telepathy and faith, new inventions of literary radiophony. It is a matter of following the author beside herself or himself, of trying to take account of the revolution that Freud's thinking has set in motion and which we have scarcely begun to reckon with. For example, concerning his remarkable contention originally formulated in a letter to his friend Wilhelm Fliesch in 1897 that there are no indications of reality in the unconscious, so that one cannot distinguish between truth and fiction that has been cathected with affect. Reality literature would start from the desire to think literature and magic, psychoanalysis and telepathy differently, starting from the place, as strange as a weather-worn highway stone, as fresh as reality, in the light of which, to quote Derrida, it is at once possible and necessary for desire to reach where the distinction between phantasm and the so-called actual or external reality does not yet take place and has no place to be. Reality literature, of course, it's madness. A mad oxymoron that would appear to be at issue in a certain essay by Freud, where he contends that a certain effect, to let it remain nameless here, as if henceforth always still to be named, a certain effect is produced when the distinction between reality and imagination, or between fiction and real life, is effaced. Reality literature, if there is any, is what happens in a ghostly fashion, perhaps, for ghosts are always fleeting. But I hear someone speaking in my head, a cold, sharp voice, as fresh as reality. Time is over.